Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The Exxon Valdez supertanker ran aground in Prince William Sound on March 24, 1989. What unfolded was one of the world's worst ecological disasters, as 11 million gallons of oil coated the pristine Alaska waters, killing whales, fish, birds, and other wildlife caught in its path. Today, the visible signs of the spill are largely gone, but many Alaska Native residents still see lasting effects of the spill and the damage it caused. We'll look back on the Exxon Valdez oil spill 35 years later, coming up after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Researchers are working to understand factors underlying maternal health care for Native women in western South Dakota. Most counties west of the Missouri River are considered a maternal health care desert. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger reports, that means women live more than 100 miles away from medical providers that specialize in delivery.
Distance, weather, transportation, and trauma are just a few of the barriers standing in the way of pregnant Native American women needing or wanting prenatal health care. That's coupled with a lack of providers West River, both in reservations and in the Black Hills. Dr. Amy Elliott is a chief research officer at Avera McKinnon. She describes the issue bluntly.
It's crisis levels with the lack of obstetrics providers, especially on the western side of the state. And how do we find solutions, not just for recruiting more people, but also do we have to think a little bit different about how we deliver care?
According to the South Dakota Department of Health, from 2012 to 2021, American Indians made up 20% of all live births, but 44% of all pregnancy-associated deaths. Elliott and others want to fully understand what's causing that issue and others. Elliott says a lack of data hinders insight into understanding causes or generating solutions.
An advantage of being within a health system is we have access to quite a bit of data, and we also have close partnerships with the Department of Health, with Great Plains Tribal Leaders Board, and other community agencies around. And so we're able to help maybe combine some different data streams that haven't been combined before.
That, Elliott hopes, will lead to lasting and systemic change in better health outcomes for Native women on the Great Plains. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
A new documentary spotlights the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa and the tribe's David versus Goliath battle against the Line 5 pipeline. The film started screening in select theaters last week. Lena Tran of WUWM in Milwaukee has more.
The Bad River Band is up against the Canadian energy company Enbridge. 12 miles of pipeline runs through the Bad River Reservation. It's a fight the band says is necessary to defend Lake Superior from the aging pipeline and protect the lake for future generations. Running Horse Livingston is a Bad River member featured in the film.
We're fighting this battle for water, but it's really a battle for our home and keeping it safe and keeping it beautiful the way that it has been for forever.
The film says there's no evidence the band ever consented to the pipeline. A federal judge ruled that Enbridge is trespassing and has 3 years to shut it down. The film argues this is only the latest chapter in the tribe's long fight for sovereignty. Here's producer, writer, and director Mary Mazzio.
And, you know, long after this challenge, there will be another one, because that's just the history of who we are as a country. This is a very, very precarious situation happening in real time.
Erosion near the banks of the Bad River has stoked the band's concerns that the exposed pipeline could rupture. Their urgency grows as climate change makes extreme rainfall and flooding more and more likely. For National Native News, I'm Lena Tran in Milwaukee.
The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and the Kiowa Tribe in Oklahoma are hosting a Veterans Benefits event on April 5th. Tribal Veteran Service officers and other advocates are expected to be on site at the tribe's community center to assist veterans, spouses, and widows with VA claims. According to the VA, collaborations with other tribes across the country are in the works to hold similar events. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Board promotes Indian artists of federally recognized tribes through its online source directory. Information on this no-charge opportunity available at doi.gov/IACB, who support this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Native communities of Alaska's Prince William Sound still see the effects of 11 million gallons of crude oil flooding the region's waters more than three decades ago. In March 1989, the Exxon Valdez oil tanker, carrying millions of gallons of crude oil from Prudhoe Bay, collided with a reef in the Sound. Over 1,000 miles of coastline were covered in oil. Thousands of seals, birds, and whales and other wildlife were killed. At the time, it was the largest oil spill in the United States. Today on our show, we'll talk to some of those who witnessed the spill 35 years ago. We also want to hear from our listeners, especially those of you in Alaska. Was your native village affected by the Exxon Valdez spill? What do you remember about it? How did the spill affect your culture? Join our conversation with comments or questions by calling in at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. That'll connect you directly with our studio in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can also leave a comment on our website and social media pages. Joining us now from Anchorage, Alaska, is Dune Lankard. He is a sea captain and a founder and president of the Native Conservancy. He is Eyak Athabascan. Good morning, Dune, and welcome back to Native America Calling.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for thinking of me.
Absolutely. Also in Anchorage, we have Sherry Beretta. She is the chair of the board for the Chugach Alaska Corporation, and she is Aleutic from the native village of Tatitluk. Good morning, Sherry, and welcome back to you too.
Good morning. Thank you.
And our third guest today is also in Anchorage, Alaska, Stan Jones. He is an author and a former journalist. Stan, good morning and welcome to our show.
Good morning and thanks for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to have all of you on our show today. I can't believe that it's been 35 years. I still remember, you know, of course, reading about this and seeing it on the news. Dune, help us out here and take us back. You were a commercial fisherman at the time when the Exxon Valdez ruptured and it sent oil flowing through Prince William Sound. What do you remember about that experience?
Well, it was surreal, I think, for everyone. You know, we had always known that an oil spill would happen. We just hoped that it wouldn't be of that magnitude. And industry and government had, you know, told us things like, well, a spill of this magnitude would only happen once in every 300-400 years. Well, it happened in like the 13th year of operation. And so it was our worst nightmare coming to reality. And I remember first heading out to sea and trying to imagine what I was going to encounter. And I've never gone to war, but it felt like we were going to war. We were heading out on the sea and started running into oil everywhere in the water and on the beaches and dead animals floating. And, you know, I realized right away that we had already lost the war because the oil was in the water. Once the oil is in the water, it's over. There's nothing you can do to clean it up.
It really does sound surreal, Dune. What about the village of Eyak? How is it affected?
Well, the actual village is to the west of, to the east of the Exxon Valdez oil spill that happened at Bly Reef near Tetlik. And the oil was traveling to the west. And so the first 3 days was calm. After that, the oil spill was moving upwards of 70 miles a day to the west. And so even though Cordova and our village didn't have any oil right on the beaches, it impacted our fisheries and everything that we had done in the ocean. For example, you know, we spent a month on the sea every year when the herring would return, because 200,000 ton of herring would return to Prince William Sound, and the entire sound would just light up with life. It would come to life. You would have, you know, seals and whales and sea lions and birds, and, you know, everyone was taking advantage of the herring, because herring are like torpedoes of energy. They're just amazing critters that fed everyone, including us. And so we would be enthralled in a month-long herring fishery of different types of gathering herring. And that was over. And so there was closed areas to fishing. You know, there was oil everywhere. I mean, we were sick, you know, just of everything that had happened. And, you know, the promises, we just felt betrayed. So it impacted everybody mentally and physically and emotionally, spiritually. And it still does today.
Dune, had you experienced oil spills before Exxon Valdez? And if so, at the time, could you tell, hey, that this is bigger? This is a lot bigger and a lot worse than what we've had before.
I have, you know, heard of spills, and I, you know, being a conservationist and a preservationist, I'd always, you know, studied the environment, and I never trusted industry ever. And so I knew that this one was bad because the water was colder. And, you know, prior to the Exxon Valdez, we had one of the most pristine, vibrant, thriving ecosystems on planet Earth, and resilient. And so, you know, what a lot of people don't realize is that 25 years prior to the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1964 on Good Friday, we had the Good Friday earthquake that rocked our world and fisheries. And 25 years later, to the almost to the same day, we had the Good Friday Exxon Valdez oil spill on March 24th, 1989. So again, it rocked our world and our fisheries. But what happened between those two events was that the resilience of the ocean was taking care of itself. It was recovering and starting to rebound. And, you know, and so we felt like, you know, things were going to be okay. But we knew that in this environment, because it was colder, it would be and rougher, you know, because after that third day, you know, when the weather kicks up, you're not going to be able to do much in the form of any kind of cleanup in this kind of environment. So we knew this was as bad as it gets.
Okay, so that colder weather just would have made it harder for crews to get out there and do any kind of damage control, it sounds like.
Yeah, and when you think about oil spills, even today, the number one response to an oil spill is dispersants. You know, sink it, get it out of public view, figure out how to reduce the damages, because if you can't see it, then you think the damage is less. But what dispersants do, and one of them is called Corexit, like, you know, it's supposed to, but it doesn't. And what it does is it sinks those that oil into the water column. And so it actually does more damage. It's like pouring carburetor fluid directly into the ocean. So It does more damage than the spill itself. And we are used as a guinea pig in the sound, as some of the other folks are going to talk about, because they use bioremediation on us to, you know, try and gobble up some of the oil and the incoming tide was floated out. They used hot water washes on the beaches and rags. Some of the people around the world sent, you know, thousands and thousands of rags to, you know, wipe the oil off of the rocks. And that was probably, you know, one of the best responses. You know, they also tried to use lasers and catch the oil on fire, which was also, you know, just a joke. Probably one of the other best ways to clean up the oil was fishermen were taking 5-gallon buckets and dipping the oil out of the water. And they probably did more good than the oil spill response vessels that finally showed up on the scene.
Wow. 11 million gallons, a bucket at a time like that, dude. That's just astounding. What about the impact on the livelihoods of Alaska residents and community members? Were they ever properly compensated for damages caused by the spill?
I wish I could say yes. You know, Exxon came to town and said, we're going to make you whole again. And they certainly did. They put a big hole in everyone's heart. And they appealed our $5 billion verdict that we won in 1994 17 times until they got the Supremes of their dreams, who took the case not to set a precedent and see that justice was served, but that just us was protected. And so what they wanted to do was to make sure that there wasn't a 17-to-1 payout on punitives. So they wanted to get it as low as they could. And so they did. They got it down to $500 million, which was a 2-to-1 payout for compensatory damages. And so that $500 million was equivalent to 1 year of bad fishing in Alaska.
Gee whiz. Okay, Dune. Well, we're going to have to take a break here, but thank you for getting this conversation started. Dune Lankard, an eyewitness there 35 years ago when the Alaska Valdez spill dumped over roughly 11 million barrels of crude oil, in 11 million gallons, excuse me, of crude oil into the waters there in Alaska. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back. After serving as Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of State, William Seward went on to make a name as the person who negotiated the U.S. purchase of Alaska. As the 49th state recognizes Seward's Day, we'll explore his legacy from a Native standpoint. That's on the next Native America Calling.
OCO, celebrate National Nutrition Month. Choose healthier food options for you and your loved ones. Sometimes it can be difficult to make good food choices, but there are many resources that can help. For more information, visit ihs.gov/diabetes or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. We are talking about the cultural and economic effects the Exxon Valdez oil spill had on Alaska Native communities 35 years later. Were you from a village affected by the spill? Join us with a comment or question by calling 1-800-996-2848. We'd really love to hear your story today here on Native America Calling. That number again, 1-800-99-NATIVE. We also want to mention that we did reach out to the ExxonMobil Corporation to see if a representative could join us on today's show. We did not hear back from them by the time we went to air. Let's bring our next guest in now, Sherry Beretta, chair of the board for the Chugach Alaska Corporation. And Sherry, we just heard from Dune Lankard and his memories of the spill. How do you remember that first day of the spill?
Good morning, and thank you for doing this. I've participated in the past, and I really appreciate us being able to keep this alive because it was such a devastating event. I was just 24 years old when this bill happened, and the aftershocks of that devastating event are still in our community. We're still healing from that. And I was just recounting some of that and remembering that my older brother was the youngest captain on one of the spill cleanup barges, and my dad was also a captain on one of the barges, and my mom did laundry. And so it was very disruptive to our families, you know, responding. But the initial shock of it, you know, seeing the images of the black waves on our beaches, and my husband was actually in flight. He was almost to Titlick when an F-15 intercepted him and made him go back to the airport in Anchorage because they had closed the airspace above the oil spill. And, you know, it was just shock upon shock happening to us. And, you know, I was also recounting the throughout the villages, so not just to Titlick, but Chiniga and Port Gramna, Mwalik, you know, Cordova, our EAC people, and, you know, Valdez, our people in Valdez, our Seward, everybody was just shocked. The fishermen, it was springtime, so they were getting ready to go out fishing, and they had to turn their boats into spill responders. And there was a chief of the native village of Port Graham who wrote a piece called The Day the Water Died. And he said something in his piece that I'll never forget, that he's describing our way of life, that when the tide is out, the table is set. You know, many of our villages don't have stores, and so we depend on the ocean to provide that. And mm-hmm. and so it was this death upon our people.
Sherry, how long that immediate onslaught, which just you described, the black waves and just this immense damage, about how long did that period last? Was it days? Was it weeks? Was it months?
It was probably, well, I wasn't in the village, but I knew people in the village. They could smell it, you know, because it was only 3 miles away. And thankfully, the tide didn't go towards the village. It went away. So the oil never ended up on the beaches in Titlick, but they could smell it. They could hear it. They could see it. And the spill cleanup went on for months throughout the whole summer and then the following years. And they were trying different, you know, the spill cleanup really revealed a massive inadequacy in the oil industry's response capabilities. So OPA 90, and I think Stan Wolf, you know, he was on the Prince William Sound RCAC that I served on for 12 years that really held accountability to the oil industry to, you know, increase their spill prevention requirements. And the Alaska legislature got involved in requiring higher standards. And, you know, I believe that it's happened, but for Chugach Alaska Corporation, so I got involved with Chugach because I was very concerned about the Evos Trustee Council buying native lands, and I didn't want that to happen for Chugach, and so Chugach never sold their subsurface estate, and we're dealing with that today with legislation to make us whole. 242,000 acres of surface estate was sold from the villages who were economically devastated. And the trustee council, which consisted of 3 federal, 3 state agencies, settled with Exxon for $900 million, and they used half of that funding to buy native land. And, you know, Dune spoke of the civil you know, the case that went to the Supreme Court, 20 years and people dying. There was supposed to be some financial pay to these people, our people, and our companies and our villages, but that didn't happen. And so these village corporations were, you know, almost just in a desperate situation and sold their native land, which was heartbreaking to many. So it just compounded the situation. And so I threw a lot of stuff out there, and I, you know, it's really raw to me still. I've tried to not be emotional about it, but it's something that just makes my stomach turn and my heartbeat when I talk about it.
Sure, sure. I understand, Sherry. We're going to take a caller now. We have Jack, who is listening in Anchorage, Alaska. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. Are you speaking with me?
Yes, yes, Jack. Hi. This is you're on Native America Calling, and tell us more about what you remember about the oil spill.
Well, what we have to remember and we have to keep in mind is in the very beginning of the oil spill, most of the people in our community were opposed to the to where the pipeline terminus was going to be, because we didn't want the tankers to be running in and out of the Sound, because we're always fearful of a spill. Back then, Senator Ted Stevens practically guaranteed us that there was no way there could possibly be an oil spill in Prince William Sound. And he even had Von Braun, the scientist, say, you know, there's no possible way there could be an oil spill. So that, you know, having started with that, that's, you know, the background of how the whole thing was started to flesh out. And us being stewards of our area of Prince William Sound, we were very concerned about the tankers and what they were doing. And, you know, it started out in the beginning, they would, all the tankers would anchor up in at Knoll's Head and then start dumping their ballast water into Prince William Sound. So, you know, we didn't know what the impact of their ballast water was doing, and, you know, as the years were going by. But of course, the really sad thing was the Exxon Valdez running up on Bly Reef, and we were unable to discern exactly how much oil that they dumped into Prince William Sound to pollute our waters. We had you know, as far as natives go, you know, it, that time of the year the herring come in, and that's our first feed, and it has been since the beginning of time. You know, we know that we're going to be able to harvest. We survived probably a pretty stringent winter, and so here we are. It's, you know, it's basically a time for celebration for our traditional ways, because we're going to get fresh food and be able to start our summer, because that was, you know, pretty much the beginning of our spring harvest was the herring. And, you know, brought in all different kinds of food. You know, seals would come in close to shore, sea lions, whales, right, and all the food that the herring invited in with their coming in. So very important time of the year. I had a boat that we worked on the oil spill, and I told my crew, I said, you know, we're going to make sure, and we were guarding a stream. We put boom out and, you know, did whatever we could to make sure that, I said, you know, if we have to start having the salmon come back, it's going to come back in this stream. So, yeah, that's, you know, that's a recollection. And like Mr. Dooner said, you know, it was, we were all, you know, just in shock. You know, a friend of mine called me up that morning and said, "Hey, look, turn on the TV. Your worst nightmare has just happened."
Oh, geez, geez. Jack, really appreciate you calling in today and sharing your insights. And just to make it clear for our listeners, Jack is from the village of Eyak, where Dune is from. So that's his perspective on the Exxon Valdez spill. Let's hear now from Patience Anderson Faulkner, who is Sukbiak from Chugach. Faulkner is a legal technician and paralegal who worked on the class action lawsuit representing fishers and Alaska Native communities affected by the spill. She's also a retired board member of the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. Here she is speaking with our producer, Sol Traverso, about the mental strain the spill caused on one fisherman.
When I was talking to one of my fishermen, a young one, and he told me that one Sunday morning he got up and was sitting on the edge of his bed. He had moved to Wasilla to stay away from this oil spill nonsense because it was killing him. Anyway, he had a gun in his hand, and he didn't know whether he was going to shoot his wife and then himself or what. Well, anyway, I mean, the guy went to mental health, and he got help, and he got things squared away, and he moved back to Cordova where he had peers that he could relate with.
Now, some cleanup workers from the Exxon spill got sick.
Some of the workers only worked a short period, like 6 weeks. They couldn't take it anymore. It was in July, before the cleanup company provided some moderate protective gear. And I got to meet them. I was very fortunate. We had vessels that came from Florida to come help clean up, were contracted to come clean up. So we had workers from all over the place. And the support for the workers was really difficult. The cleanup company, VECO, did not have the manpower or the human power, I should say, to support what needed to be done.
What advice do you have for other communities, maybe Native communities, at risk of an oil spill?
Americans in general are asleep at the wheel. We have so much to handle on a day-to-day basis that it's very hard to keep track of these large resource extraction companies. That includes coal and timber and everything else. We need to pay attention, and we need to find a way in which to pay attention. What I found is that Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council is a wonderful tool that helps monitor the issues that transportation of natural resources has to be done. And if we have to raise the price of something to meet the safety standards, so be it. So having a regional council to pay attention to the issues, and they're all volunteers, makes sense.
That was a taped interview with Patience Anderson Faulkner. And Sherry, I want to go back to you because we heard Patience refer to just the average American as being kind of asleep at the wheel and just not dialed into the urgency of issues like this. So I think that really begs the question, could this happen again? Do you feel that the industry is still practicing some of these habits that led up to this spill? Are we still in risk? Are Alaska waters still in peril with the threat of something like this, another Exxon Valdez in the future?
Well, thank you. And thank you for playing that for Patience. She's this wonderful elder. So
I feel like with her comment about the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council and the Open 90, those requirements for spill prevention and response were, they couldn't not do it. And so in the 12 years that I was on that board, we saw the industry change there, especially the shipping companies. For them, they had to go to double hull tankers and escort systems with the tugs through the Prince William Sound out into the, you know, into the deeper water outside of Hinchinbrook. And, you know, I think those things made us feel better. And, you know, for Chugach, we partnered with Tutitlic and Chiniga to form a spill response TCC, we call it, and we've had that contract since 1994. And there's a peace of mind that we have in protecting our homelands. And we've learned to live with the industry because there's not a lot of industry in the area. So jobs that our people can have on the spill response and the, you know, there's requirements for Native hire, Alaska Native hire along the TAPS pipeline. And so those things are important. Jobs are important. They provide for the cash economy. So many of our people still live the subsistence off the land, but we're supplemented by the cash economy that exists with the industry. So we've learned to live with them.
All right, Sherry, we're going to take another break here. Listeners, give us a call if you remember the Exxon Valdez spill in March of 1989. 1-800-99-NATIVE is our phone number here at the studio.
Pursuing a degree in higher education is attainable, and with a scholarship from Native Forward Scholars Fund, it is more affordable. From aerospace to veterinary medicine, as the largest direct scholarship provider to Native students in the U.S., Native Forward has empowered over 22,000 students from over 500 tribes in all 50 states in pursuit of their undergraduate, graduate, and professional degrees. Info and applications at nativeforward.org. Who support this show.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. We are continuing our conversation about the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and you can continue this conversation on our website and social media pages like Facebook or Instagram. And our website, of course, is nativeamericacalling.com. One of our guests today, Sherry Beretta, is the chair of the board for the Chugach Alaska Corporation. And Sherry, before break, you mentioned that the oil industry provides a lot of jobs. It provides economic resources for Alaska Native communities. And even today, there are disagreements about what actually caused the spill or just some of the issues related to the spill. Talk about that a little bit more in a little bit more depth and just some of the competing interests there among some of the Alaska Native villages and other entities there with regard to how to, you know, still do some of the cleanup and restoration that has to happen.
Thank you for that question. And you know, the reality is, the oil industry is the lifeblood of Alaska and drives the ability for the government to function, the state government to function. And so, but in order to have that balance with the, you know, the people that live the lifestyle that they've lived in these villages for over 5,000 years, you have to, you know, protect them, and you have to acknowledge them and work with them. And so I think, you know, in the past, what, 35 years since the oil spill, it's happened to the extent it can. But, you look back at what caused it, it was just this wild, wild west mentality, you know, getting drunk and getting in a tanker and, you know, maneuvering through the rocks, whatever the heck was going on in the mind of that guy that went up on those rocks. And I don't think that can happen today. I have to believe in my heart that there have been, you know, standards that have been raised so that will never happen again. So that's kind of my, you know, work, my life's work is to ensure that our homelands are protected from that, and that we work hand in hand with the industry and that our people benefit from them. I mean, we have had this contract, and we're very proud to have this contract for so many years with the industry to do spill response. And we're world class. We actually had some of our people go down to New Orleans, Louisiana, when the when that disaster happened, and help those people. And when there was exploration happening up on the North Slope, our people were helping with training and different efforts. So I think that we have adapted to that mode of protecting our homelands and continuing to live our lives in the villages that we have enjoyed for thousands of years.
Well, Sherry, really appreciate your insights and all the information you're sharing here today with our listeners. Let's talk to our third guest now, who is also in Anchorage, Alaska, Stan Jones. And Stan, again, welcome to our show. And let's talk a little bit about the book that you co-authored along with Sharon Bushell. The book's titled The Spill, Personal Stories from the Exxon Valdez Disaster. What information did you learn writing that book about the spill that was most alarming to you?
Well, this book was, we produced this book in 2009 on the 28th anniversary of the spill. So by that time, of course, people had sort of decided what they thought about it. And the thing that impressed me most about it was the breadth and the depth of the impacts of that spill, not only on the communities in Prince William Sound that you've discussed, but of course, on Alaska generally, and on people in agencies who had to deal with that spill, and people who work for the oil industry, really. I thought it might be of interest. Patience and Sherry were both interviewed for the book. And what we thought of it was as it was an oral history of the oil spill. So that's the frame. Here's what a quote from Patience in her interview. They thought I might be a security risk. I felt that, well, if you think I'm a security risk, then perhaps I am one, and I worked in that manner. So as you can see, even by 20 years later, feelings ran pretty high. And Sherry, who was interviewed, said similar things to what she said today. Her quote was, one of the quotes from her was, you can't come to a land, extract their resources, gain enormous benefit, and not protect the people on whose land you've encroached. So we're happy that they got to talk in our book. One quote I wanted to read, another quote I wanted to read from this book, came from Clyde Robbins, who was a Coast Guard Vice Admiral who was involved in the response to the spill. And it may explain why the industry was really unprepared to clean up the oil that was spilled from the Exxon Valdez. And in a nutshell, they just didn't take seriously the possibility that you could clean up a meaningful amount of oil in the case of a giant oil spill. Here's what Robert
okay.
said.
All right. Stan, do me a favor. Hold that thought, because our producers are going to work with your audio a little bit. We're getting kind of a bad connection. So just go ahead and hang in there. We'll take care of it. And, Dune, I want to go back to you, because you talked earlier about the Good Friday earthquake that occurred in 1964, and then it was almost exactly 25 years later when Exxon Valdez hit. And at the time, Alaska was kind of recovering from, it took about 25 years to recover from some of the harmful effects of that earthquake. And where does it stand now in terms of the damage that's been done by Exxon Valdez? Is it pretty much, I mean, is the water better there in Prince William Sound and some of the other issues with wildlife and such, or are there still long-term lingering effects of that spill here 35 years later?
Well, thank you. The herring have yet to recover, as Jack Hopkins was saying, you know, that it was the first fish of the year, and it's when Prince William Sound would light up and all the critters, everyone made a good, happy living out there. There's still dead zones. And when you look at the herring itself, the herring for some of the fishermen was half of our annual income. You know, it was, we could make a good living from chasing that herring around for a month every year. And it the run dipped down to 4,000 ton returning, and had some oil disease and
bleeding underneath their scales and not reproducing. Now in the last 2-3 years, there has been sign where there's as many as 20,000 ton of herring returning to the sound, and we have seen plumes of herring spawn both in the Western Sound and all the way east of the Top River Delta down near Controller Bay. So that's a good thing. And, you know, as I mentioned, the resilience of the sound is wonderful, but and has, you know, helped the region recover. So when the Good Friday earthquake happened in 64 and 25 years later on the Good Friday Exxon Valdez oil spill, 25 years after that, we have the impacts of climate change. I don't know if we're going to be resilient enough to overcome that. So, you know, there's a number of changes that are happening. You know, even the ocean's conveyor belt is slowing down. You know, if that, you know, happens, life as we know it will cease to exist.
Mm-hmm. Dune, thank you. Stan, I want to go back to you. And I think one of the reasons this show is just so impactful today and so timely is 35 years ago when this spill occurred, just the huge, huge revolution that we're experiencing in this country right now with regard to alternative energy, that was in its infancy. And now there's so much debate over, do we need fossil fuels? Are there better sources of energy? What about the dangers? What about the risks? What about the environmental effects? What do you think the key takeaways are for our economy and our society today here in the United States and across the planet with regard to oil spills like this and just what it means to the environment, what it means to economies? What do you think? What's the takeaway?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway anybody should get from the Exxon Valdez oil spill and some disasters that we've had since is, I guess, that rust never sleeps. The system is always going to be under pressure to cut costs, which means its ability to respond is going to be reduced. A lot of people on here have mentioned the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. I worked there, and both Sherry and Patience were on the board. And in my view, organizations like the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council are critical because their job is to push back on this process by which things devolve over time and the national or public consciousness of disasters like the oil spill fade. The RCAC did a paper, an analysis last year of how things stand in the sound and what do we need to pay attention to. And they found some serious deficiencies at the Valdez Marine Terminal, the operation by Alyeska, where the tankers come to load oil at the end of the pipeline. They made some recommendations, and Alyeska has responded. In a capitalist system like we have, the pressure to cut costs is just relentless. It's going to happen every day of every year, and the people who in 1 year make commitments and promises, they'll be gone in a few years. They'll retire or go on to other jobs. New people will come in. They may not have the same level of commitment. They may not even be aware of all the commitments that were made earlier. So there's that tendency to relax and become complacent because no disasters have happened lately. And in fact, the reason they haven't happened may be the protections that were put in place after the last disaster, and none of these protections start to fade. So in the RCAC, you have an organization whose mission is to apply the opposite pressure and push back every time there's any attempt or tendency to relax the protections that were put in place after the last disaster. And it was a privilege to work there. It was great to work with Sherry and Patience and the other folks at the RCAC. And over time, I came to think that institutions like the RCAC are absolutely critical to push back on the inevitable tendency to relax and become complacent if there hasn't been a disaster lately.
Mm-hmm. To be, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Stan. And what else? Any other just enlightening facts or just information you didn't expect to learn that you discovered while working on your book?
Was it's my conclusion that prevention is not just the most important thing, but almost the only thing. Cleaning up serious amounts of oil after a major oil spill is extremely difficult. There were promises from the industry that they would clean up every drop and so on after the Exxon Valdez, but they didn't, they couldn't. And probably if it happened again today, it'd be a better response, but still a lot of oil would get away. Before the break, going to read a quote from a Coast Guard admiral who was involved in the cleanup. And it demonstrates, I think, that the system, the industry, plus the regulatory agencies, at least at that time, didn't take very seriously the idea that you could do a meaningful cleanup after a big oil spill. And he said this, some pretty important people said, we might be better off doing nothing and letting Mother Nature take care of it. But doing nothing wasn't an option, ever. We had to do something, even if it was just looking busy. And hopefully things have improved in terms of how the industry thinks about the possibility of response to a big oil spill. Mm-hmm. But I think the underlying proposition still has some merit. You can never clean it all up, which takes me back to the main point. Prevention is absolutely of the essence. It's the most important thing.
Stan, what about lingering health effects? Are there people sick today or people that have had long-term health issues because of the spill 35 years ago?
You know, I would defer to others on that, like Dune, because the mission of the RCAC where I worked was operations, really, as opposed to health.
Sure. Let's ask Sherry. Sherry, because both your brother and your father were captains on cleanup barges. Any long-term health ramifications in your family or other families you know?
Thank God neither my dad, whose birthday it is today, he's turning 81. Happy birthday, Richard Randazzo. he's good. And my brother, he still works on in Valdez on the spill response team at CERVS and TCC. But you know, I know that we have had some of our people from our communities and villages get cancer, stomach cancer, and that was always a concern. The Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council really only looked at the environment. They didn't look at the people. The people weren't considered a part of the environment, so they didn't study the impacts that the oil may have had on the fish that the people had to continue to eat to survive. And so I think that was a flaw in the big grand picture. I mean, the notion that instead they would use that money to buy our land to protect it from future oil spills, to me, was just a gross misuse of public funds.
All right. Well, Sherry, thank you for joining our show, and I want to wish your father a happy birthday as well, and appreciate all of our other guests and our caller who joined the conversation as well. Listeners, please join us next week for another lineup of conversations about Indigenous issues and topics. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our producers are Andy Murphy and Sol Traverso. Thanks to Alaska producer Rhonda McBride for her help on today's show. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Sho McPolin is the digital producer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief operations officer. The president and CEO of Kawanak Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. Have a safe weekend. I'm Sean Spruce.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Act protects authentic American Indian and Alaska Native artists and craftspeople and their art and craftwork. Under the Act, it is illegal to market art or craftwork misrepresented as American Indian, Indian, Native American, or Alaska Native made, or as the product of a particular Indian tribe. Reporting potential Act violations can be done at doi.gov/IACB or at 1-888-ART-FAKE. Support provided by Indian Arts and Crafts Board.
Hey, Shay, it's February and American Heart Month. Donya yu yana itonan I kwani kinate donyam temakwe kokshunawa. Ike na weaka takwenulawa kona yoe a les nake donyam asa shina donyante kunashna atekena. Yam donakwa mos awa shuwa tuta iston healthcare.gov finawan and ta iston 1-800-318-2596 na penan akanatu. Look at Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services donapen and itulokanawe. Elakwa.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.